Raj. A panorama of British India, recorded by some of those who lived in it. Program 2. Lances and Rifles.
The Indian Army was the pride of the Raj. It was the biggest volunteer professional army in history.
I commanded a company of my regiment in Gallipoli on the 4th of June 1915. The regiment was then about 700 men strong. We went into the attack and we came out with about 70 men and one officer. And not a single man turned and ran. They went on and on with bomb and bayonet until they were slaughtered to a man. I'd never been so impressed with the sheer bravery of men who, after all, had no interest in our troubles. They didn't care a damn word about the Germans or anybody else. They fought for the honor of their regiment. They just fought because they were the 14 Sikhs in their opinion were the finest regiment in the world, and they weren't going to turn their backs on anything. It was appalling, but by God, what can you say?
The most exciting sound for me was the sound of the irregular Punjab regiment playing the Dhillon Shana. And they just had these, and they had counter rhythms. I remember the one beat was dum 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 dum. And oh, they're marvelous. And I kind of think, oh, marvelous, marvelous days. And they come in with trail arms like this, and they'd throw their rifle up in the air, like catch it in their left arm, all of this, and then stamp their foot and fire one round in synchronizing with the drum. They go left, right, It was sensational. This tremendous regiment came bursting into the dust on the heels of an English regiment. They used to knock me out because they used to wear these great long pantaloons, a gold dome to their turban, like a saffron turban, khaki shirts with the banded waistcoats, double-crossed bandoliers, leather sandals. That's right. That was their get-up. And they used to march very fast, I remember, like this.
At the centenary celebrations in 1957, I presented my uncle's medal to the 6th Lancers, my uncle, General Sir Moseley Mains, regiment with whom he was connected for 37 years. They had some 150 pensioners there, and I was asked to meet them. A very old man came up, buried his white beard in my chest, and sobbed. I couldn't make out what he was saying, so I patted him on the shoulder, and then the truth came out. He pulled up his trousers and showed a very, very badly wounded knee. And he explained to me that in a charge in Mesopotamia in 1915, he'd been hit by a Turkish bullet, fell off his horse, and that my uncle had dismounted and carried him off the field. Needless to say, I just burst into tears as well. And after all, I wasn't in the army. I just happened to be a nephew, but I happen to be a main.
Not so much an army, more a way of life. The last commander-in-chief of all India, Field Marshal Auchinleck, joined it in 1904. The 62nd Punjabis.
You see, the British officer of an Indian regiment, his relationship with the men was quite different. Mind you, I'm talking about a long time ago. Yes, it bordered on paternalism, but what it meant was that your relationship with the men off duty, if you took them out shooting or went on leave and took a couple of orderlies with you, you were talking as I would talk to you, and they would talk to me. There's no question of ordering them about. After a parade in the morning, the men immediately got into their own Indian native clothing. They took off the uniform straight away. Mind you, the discipline, the saluting and all that sort of thing was just the same. But the atmosphere is quite different. There wasn't so much stamping of feet. And that, I think, is what made the Indian Army so popular and so beloved, I think, by the British officers who served in it. Because they felt they belonged to a family. It was a family, with a son followed father and never followed uncle in that way.
The Indian Army in about 1910, 11, 12, and 13 was the thing. If you couldn't get into the Guards or crack cavalry or infantry regiments, it was the Indian Army to go for.
The Indian Army, in some ways, was very much a sort of family affair. Sons followed their fathers, and naturally, the regiment who'd had a distinguished father was inclined to accept the son.
But, as always with the Raj, it wasn't all traditions and ideals. Sometimes the beginnings were quite hard-headed.
Well, I joined the Indian Army because my mother had been left very badly off. My father was a soldier. There were four of us. He died untimely. We were all young. And I wanted to be a soldier, and I had either to be a gunner or a sapper, in which in those days you could live on your means. You couldn't live on your means in the ordinary infantry or the cavalry or the Indian Army. It really was financial. And that's the reason I could live in India on my pay fairly well. We got into a little debt to begin with, but by and large, you were careful. You could live on your pay.
But when you had passed well out of Sandhurst, that was simply test number one for acceptance into the special world of the Indian Army.
When I left Sandhurst and was commissioned into what they called the unattached list of the Indian Army, I came out to India attached to a British regiment for 1 year.
The first regiment that I joined before I actually went into the Indian Army was the Duke of Wellington's regiment. And the Dukes were, I think, one of the funniest regiments I've met. A girl, good, tough English county regiment. The mess was pretty stuffy. Yeah? I was terrified of the commanding officer. Everybody was. They always should be. I was equally terrified of the majors. The senior subaltern put the fear of God into us. Every night, we changed into mess kit. Every night, silver was on the table. Every night, the mess sergeant, Sergeant Burberry by name, would take round the wines, nudge you, port Madeira, Masala, please, I remember he always used to say. And you had to have a glass of port or Madeira or Masala. You jolly well had to do it. And it was rather expensive on a pay of 5 shillings and 3 pence a day. No wonder we were all in debt by the time we joined the Indian Army.
And during that 1 year, you are supposed to get to know your Indian regiments, be seen by them, be accepted by them, and so on.
During that first year came test number two, the awesome vetting.
The regiment would always invite an attached officer, an officer who had put down their regiment. They would invite him to stay for 2 or 3 days, and that was a great ordeal.
I was asked to go and stay with the 2nd Gurkhas, and I spent a week with them in their mess. And I was not selected. And I often rather wondered why. And I found out the reason after I had retired some time ago. I sent them a check in payment for my mess bill, and I forgot to sign it. And I think the Gurkhas thought, here is a pretty crooked sort of a chap. We don't want him.
But when you eventually got through test number two, you at last exchanged your British mess for an Indian Army one.
The officer's mess was the center of regimental life, because here the unmarried officers spent a great deal of their spare time, and in particular dined together every night. Dinner in the mess was a most extraordinary meal, because although we were living in fairly primitive surroundings, we always had a most elaborate dinner of about six courses. In fact, this was a rather feature of Indian life. You invariably started with what was called a first toast, a sardine or half a boiled egg on a piece of soggy toast. You then went on to tinned fish. You then had a joint, a pudding, and a savoury called the second toast. And if you'd started with a sardine, then you finished with a boiled egg, and vice versa. But as soon as the second toast had been served, the mess sergeant placed three decanters in front of the senior officer. Port, Madeira, and masala. After the wine had circulated, and as soon as the senior officer had lighted his cheroot, or what you will, one was free to smoke. But one was not free to leave the table until the senior officer did. And this really resulted in a great many extremely boring evenings, especially some of these old gentlemen who insisted upon telling their stories of prowess in the hunting field and so on, which we'd heard innumerable times.
The older officers certainly drank a great deal in those days, but the thing that always surprised me was their capacity for holding their drink. One might have a very riotous guest night, finishing, say, at 3 a.m, but at the 6 o'clock mounted parade, these same officers would be there on time, impeccably turned out, and able to sit their horses without any suspicion that they had been the worse for wear just a few hours previously.
In the mess, the only person that you sir is the colonel. Whereas on parade, you're the marchant or whatever it is. But in the mess, you are Pat or George or Geoffrey or whatever the name might be. It's your home, and you do exactly as you please in it.
When we were in the south of India, the mess we occupied at the time had a ballroom. And this ballroom used to be cleared at the time of the gala guest nights when we had fellow officers to dine to enable us to use the dance floor as a sort of racetrack for bicycle races. This nearly always ended by a large number of windows being broken, and the following day we would persuade one of the senior officers of the regiment to certify that there had been a storm the previous night.
But though you had joined your regiment, you were still on trial. Test number 3 was perhaps the stiffest so far.
When I first took over command of a company of Gurkhas, I had untold doubts. I was frightened. I wasn't very au fait with the language. The men weren't too au fait with me. They'd never heard me. And it was a very frightening time. All viceroys, commissioned officers, Gurkha officers, Indian officers in other Indian regiments, your subedars, jemadar, subedar major, wonderful fellows, God's own gentlemen. They feel absolutely for you and help you all along the line. But they don't do it too obviously. But if they think, and they're not far wrong in what they think, that you can do it without help, they'll jolly well make you do it. And then comes the wonderful day. And it happens in a day when you realize that what you're saying is getting through to the men. When you get a smile from one of the men, although you've talked to him in the most execrable Gurkhali, and he's a Jihos and smiles at you, you've got through to them. And it all happens just in one day like that.
So you were wedded to your regiment at last, and on honeymoon.
From the day a man joined his unit and came under your command, he became yours. You knew all about him. You probably visited his village and actually knew his parents, and he certainly relied on you if ever he was in trouble at home over, say, a lawsuit or trouble with a moneylender all the other things that can happen to villagers in India the same as anywhere else.
Hello, the vocabulary. The Bengal lancers. All pretty crack and all pretty good and all much sought after. And of course, their uniforms were tremendous. Bright yellow and God knows what. Puggeries and saffas and all those things. Enough to rejoice the heart of any young man. Carnivore's piece simply wasn't in it.
The Armistice Day Parade on the polo grounds of Pune. That was the most fantastic spectacle I will ever see off the screen. And the colours are as vivid to me at this moment as they were then. There was the entire spectrum of the Indian lancers, each one of which wore a different coloured turban. There was the scarlet turban, scarlet and khaki and black breeches with the blue and white pennant. There was the Bengal lancers who had a multicoloured turban, striped. I think it was blue and white. I might be wrong. It's a long time ago. I remember the officers wore dark blues and some of the NCOs wore red tops with different coloured pennants. Then there was the regiment that wore the all-black turban with a sort of a band down the side. Yes, yes, Skinner's horse, yes. With the yellow uniforms, that's right. And the horses themselves were all carefully graded. There was whites, roans, bays, all different colours. Each looked as if, it looked as if somebody had done a decor for what coloured horses would go with what coloured uniforms and turbans. And the noise, the jingle of the harness, and the shouting of the various commands. There was the Dogras, the Rajputs, the Hindis, all the Pathan regiments, the Waziris Irregulars. But the orders were shouted out by the white officers in all the different languages. It was a marvellous spectacle. And the limbers with the guns burnished bright like gold. And all the sices standing along the side there holding the horses for the colonels waiting to go on board.
In an Indian cavalry regiment, the absolute height of success was if you were a good polo player and played in the regimental team. If you played in the regimental polo team, you were tantamount to a god.
Indeed, the horse was as big a symbol of power and splendor in the Raj as it was in medieval Europe. Something of a religion for both sexes.
In the winter, the Indian army, who were in considerable force in Peshawar, brought out their daughters and their sisters, who perhaps had an idea of finding a nice young man, which they did. But they were a most awfully jolly lot of girls. You know, they were penniless and they were full of fun and games and jollity and rode anything with four legs in the hunt and fell into every river and had to be pulled out and, generally speaking, added an enormous amount of sparkle to our lives.
And when I arrived in Amritsar, I was at once pursued by about 49 subalterns. When I say 49, that's figurative. There weren't 49 soldiers in Amritsar, I don't think. But there were two. I remember we called them Piggy and Wiggy. And they both followed my cousin and I. We both, of course, were 17 together. And we were pursued by these and by all sorts of other birds who were around. And then later, when we went up to Kashmir in the hot weather, we had a whale of a time.
However hot the pursuit, it was on a tight rein. Once you were wedded to the regiment, a second wife was out for a long time.
Indeed, if you got yourself embroiled as a young officer with any young lady, the colonel would very much put his foot down and say, you are not getting married yet. You see, we didn't get marriage allowance until we were 26 years of age.
I think it would be fair to say that most wives tended to acquire the rank of their husbands. I mean, the colonel's lady regarded herself as a sort of colonel. And certainly she commanded all the other wives in the regiment. In Lansdowne, we had a most superb example of a memsahib you could find anywhere in India, I think. She was known as Mrs. Fither. She was the widow of an officer who had died as a subaltern many, many years ago, but she had stayed on in Lansdown and had gradually become, over the years, the sort of super colonel of the regiment. Nothing was done without reference to her. I think nobody would have been so bold as to get married without asking Mrs. Fizzer's advice as to the suitability of the proposed bride.
I was married in Lucknow Garrison Church, and the band of the Norfolk Regiment played in the choir stalls.
I married an Indian cavalry officer, Bengal Lancer, Province Horse. I think, apart from the falling in love and so on, I was greatly attracted to cavalry life because I was very, very, very keen and interested in anything to do with horses. And, if I may say so, I had a certain competence as a horsewoman. So I went to become an army wife, and I hated it. I really disliked the life. It was a total loss of the quality of life, at any rate for the women. Excessively boring, trivial, claustrophobic, confined, and totally male-orientated, totally. The army wife was not expected to do anything or to be anything. She was not expected to be clever. It didn't even matter, really, if she was beautiful, as long as she looked reasonable and dressed reasonably and didn't let her husband down by making outrageous remarks at the dinner table. She certainly had wonderful opportunities for riding. But apart from that, and from looking after her children and running a fairly decent dinner party, there her role ended.
Or did it?
The big parades for the King's birthday, when they came past the saluting base, it's a wonderful thing, a horse parade. There's nothing to compare with it. And a great sense of brotherhood. Life with the army is very moving in many ways because of the tremendous sense of community that you get from being one of the same lot and the same spirit. And there's no question that it's a beautiful thing to see a parade of Indian mounted troops. And of course, if your husband is leading the parade, it's a very handsome man, which he was, and beautifully dressed and waving the sword. It was extremely moving to me, that sort of thing.
Test number four went on for years.
The Sikh is one of the most interesting men in the world and one of the most difficult to command. Physically, they are as fine a race of men as any of the world can produce. Alexander the Great, when he came out and invaded India, settled most of that part of the northwestern Punjab with his Greek soldiers, and my own opinion is that the Sikh and the Punjabi as a whole has a very, very great mixture in him of the Greek. You have only to see the Sikh's wrestling, and of course the Sikh with his turban and his long rolled beard is a man to whom personal looks mean a tremendous amount. They know they're good looking. Nobody more so than the Sikh. You see him looking at himself in the glass, picking his teeth, rolling his moustache, and generally making the most of his looks. You see a lot of Sikhs together in plain clothes in their various coloured turbans. They're an absolute picture for an artist. You see it every individual Sikh's turban is most beautifully tinted to go with the shade of the particular clothes he's wearing. A light blue or a light pink or an orange one, whatever it may be.
Punjabis had some very good songs. Most of them would be unprintable if translated, but they were good marching songs with a good swing, and one got to know a lot of them by heart. Oh, my boli, oh, to boli, da 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 to boli. I've forgotten, but that's the sort of thing that they sing. La da 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 da, and so on and so on. Famous Pathan tune called Zakhmi Dil, which is the wounded heart. That has exceedingly rude words. There's a boy across the river with a bottom like a peach, but a laugh I cannot swim. Sikhs show off their rivals. Their rival Sikhs. For instance, if as you walk down the platform, as we say, of a railway station, you twirl your moustache and you say, the man as you pass, it's a challenge. You can imagine one of the musketeers doing that kind of thing. And we had many cases in the regiment of chaps who came to blows, very often with hockey sticks. Awful trouble, broken heads and heaven knows what. And you say, what's the trouble? Why did this man in such a... Whoa! And I walked down the platform, he twirled his moustache and he went, whoa!
That was the kind of knowledge you got into your blood as you slowly progressed from second lieutenant to captain and moved with the Memsahib round the dusty cantonments of India.
Well, I lived 4 years in Meerut, and both my children were born when I was there, so I have a particular feeling for the place. And it's a place of a tremendous character, of course, a very, very old cantonment. And finally, it is the place where the mutiny broke out. We were in a cavalry brigade there, and we had the lines where the mutiny broke out. We were living in the bungalows where the women, children, the families lived, the British families of the officers of those mutiny regiments. And on the gates of these bungalows were plaques which said, here, Mrs. So-and-so and her three children were killed and thrown down a well. Or here, Captain and Mrs. So-and-so were found hiding and killed and so on. Funnily enough, at the time, it never entered my head for one moment to be distressed or angered by the fact that the Indians had killed them. I didn't think of the mutiny as being horrible behavior on the part of either Indians or British. I just thought of it as an event that had happened that was historic and dramatic. And I rather liked living in these bungalows. It so happened that my own bungalow, which was very beautiful, old-fashioned, very old, mutiny period, had no plaque on it, so I don't know what's happened there. And it wasn't a bungalow that was haunted, that I'm quite sure of. It was a beautiful old bungalow with a huge thatched roof. It came quite low down over the verandas, keeping the house very cool in the summer. And it had a very, very beautiful garden, full of roses and every form of beautiful annual. I loved that house, but there was a bungalow near with a plaque on it where a woman and her three children had been killed in a well. And my husband went in there to stay when I was up in the hills. And they all found it almost impossible to sleep in the house at night. They had to take their beds out in the garden, not only for the heat, but because things happened like doors which had been shut blew open when there was no wind. And dogs would never stay in the house. And it was, in fact, haunted. And they all felt it and they all hated it.
The long test number 4 involved not only professionalism, but morality. Officers and gentlemen. It was a morality that aimed high and was subject to complex tensions.
The regiment had its own way of dealing with situations, and this in a queer sort of way I resented, because I felt that there was not much privacy in India anyway, and there was absolutely no privacy in regimental life, none whatsoever. Every facet of your life was known, with the side result, I may say, that there was also virtually no immorality whatsoever, because of the extraordinary communal life which we led. If Major so-and-so had been paying court to Mrs. somebody else, this would have been spotted instantly. And no doubt, Mrs. somebody else's husband would have seen that Major so-and-so transferred to one of the courts.
So it had, I suppose, a sort of bonus of an extremely moral existence. But, oh, my goodness, it was dull.
The hot weather was a difficult time for many people. The planes began to heat up in about early March. The wives had to go to the hills. And the wives very often got bored in the hills without their husbands.
Oh, separation. You see, in the hills, you get a nice man who was on leave for 2 months the time your husband wasn't there. And you set up a flirtation, and that may have led to something more serious, or it may not.
There were certain hill stations to which colonels would not allow their subalterns to go on leave. Poodle-faking stations, they were called. So if you said to the agent, "I'm due for my privilege leave 2 months," he'd say, "Well, what's your address on leave?" And you said, "Well, a houseboat in Srinagar, or a club in Gulmerg, or perhaps a hotel in Missouri or somewhere." He'd say, "Well, I don't think the CO will countenance that."
Well, you know, servants know everything. And there's nothing, virtually nothing, that happened in a British household which wasn't gossiped within 10 minutes in the servants' quarter. But servants were broad-minded. That is to say, if the master of the house was carrying on with somebody of his own status, they regarded it as his privilege. And there was no gossip. But if he made the mistake of falling in love with a gardener's wife, which is unthinkable, but it did happen occasionally, or should he say picked up an Indian nurse or an Anglo-Indian nurse, then of course he was infringing the code. And everybody learned about it through the servant grapevine. But if the colonel's wife was sleeping with a general, or vice versa, there was a tight-lipped silence in the servants' quarters. And British in India got away with quite a bit. Now, there was another difference. For example, let us take a young army officer who went off for a shoot in the hills. Now, he would possibly take a Jawan as his shikari. Now, the Jawan would pimp for him and think it quite normal, largely because morality in the hills is not very outstanding, shall we say. And secondly, because he was out of the system for the time being. He was no longer a captain or a colonel or a general. He was a shikari. And nobody thought anybody the worse for it. And it was accepted.
There was a regiment which was known as the Fornicating Fifth, because everybody did swap wives so busily amongst themselves. But I think it was extremely rare for anybody to have sexual relations with an unmarried girl. I think there was quite a good deal of adultery. But girls were not considered fair game.
There was a frightful lot of chitter-chat, most of it completely bogus, and I think 99% of those little liaisons in the hills were as harmless as you can think of. I mean, I've been kissed, and I've kissed. That's the end of it.
On this moral question in regiments, there was a very strong unwritten law that regimental officers could have little affairs with wives of other regiments, but it was very much frowned upon that it should ever happen with a wife in your own regiment. And so strongly was this law obeyed that in a frontier station, when the husband was away campaigning, it was generally considered wise for the wife left behind to have a young officer who may have been on regimental duties to sleep overnight in the bungalow as a guard. And as far as I know, this privilege, if you can call it that, was never abused, ever.
From the time I got to India in 1919 until I went to Army headquarters in 1936, there was never a time when there was no fighting going on the frontier, in one sector or another.
So, sooner or later, even quite apart from the two world wars, the time would come for the fifth and last test for admission into the complete brotherhood of the Indian Army.
No, one certainly didn't feel exhilarated. I think anybody likes danger. But you braced yourself against it. After we were all regular soldiers. To run away or to show cowardice on a frontier campaign and come back and dine or wine with your brother officers in the evening is a far worse punishment than risking death.
There's no doubt, to my mind, you never get used to being shot at. And the idea that the old soldier's the most courageous, I think, is entirely erroneous. I was certainly much more courageous the first day I went into action. In fact, I thought it was my duty to run from one platoon trench to the other with a whole lot of people firing at me. I never thought that, even on the second day, I'd lost that first euphoria. But my opinion is you only have so much courage, and that can be drained away. It can be replenished.
That's a very difficult question, I think, to say what makes you go on. I think it's bred in you by your life as a soldier, even in peacetime. And I think the knowledge that if you fail, that your men will fail too. I've been as frightened as anybody, in that fact, especially in Mesopotamia. But one went on because one never had to go on. I have seen a British officer lying in a hole and pulled him out of it, but there's not very many. Yes, I think fatalism does come into it. Because, you see, it's just the luck of the draw, really. I mean, you must accept the fact that people are going to be killed.
But to replace those who were killed, as well as those who went back to their villages with the dignity of medals and pensions, there were always sons and nephews and grandsons to follow in each generation.
And boys of 16, 17 would come up to you and ask how their names put down. You'd measure them and look at them and say, we'll come up again in 2 years' time. It is a bit of family affair, the whole thing, really.
Generally, these recruiting tours are almost in the nature of a triumphal procession, because at the entrance to one village area, you'd be met, generally, by the local village band. Big drummer, pipes, side drums, the lot. Many of them, of course, retired drummers from the old regiment. And they give a reception, and the old Indian officers would come out and meet you. And then on you'd go to the village you'd intended to visit. Then you'd be received by your head host, generally one of the senior Indian Viceroy's commissioned officers, and then you are brought out under the great village tree, the people tree, under which the whole village can come and sit. And there there'd be a table with a white cloth on it, and I would sit with the senior Indian officer, and always in front of me, the recruiting officer, was a bottle of whiskey. And that whiskey had to be finished. They thought of it, you drank as much as they could possibly put into it. They were experts when you were turning away, talking to the chap on your left, or listening to a complaint over the end of the table, your glass was being surreptitiously filled. And my whiskey bottle was shared with the Indian officers. And we'd sit and we'd talk and we'd discuss old friends and all the old times, all the old regimental stuff that nobody else could understand. It was a breath of life to all these ships. And when I'd leave in the morning, they'd all come out, the whole lot. They'd take me with the band all to the village boundary. And as I'd leave, they'd all shout out the Sikh war cry as I left, you know. Sat Sri Akal, and I'd shout back to them, Sat Sri Akal. Oh, I did hear commandment like this. Wonderful. Marvelous.
Not so much an army, more a way of life.
All over India, on New Year's Day, it was the great traditional day when every regiment corps unit paraded before the most senior officer. And this really was rather a moving and splendid sight. There was a great deal of jingling harness and the cavalry regiments with pennants flying from their lances and horses tossing their heads, all beautifully groomed. But what was nice to know was that these soldiers were not only decorative, but they were also very brave and had proved themselves in many wars, not their wars, as mercenaries, if you like. But their loyalty, I should think, was almost unique. They were prepared, without question, to die for their British masters and officers on a field of battle in which they had no vestige of interest themselves.
Ah, God, the picture. Oh, somebody didn't get some moving colour film of that. They missed it all. Then there was, of course, the elephant gun batteries, the siege batteries. They used to come on, let me see, a phalanx of six in line, and they had, they were all polished up too, just like the horses. All their little toes had all been polished up, and they whitened up. They had leather harness, and the regimental banner was hung on their forehead, of the lead one, I remember, the one in the middle. And the Mahouts wore a striped turban. It was dark blue with a narrow red stripe, and they used to come in with a drum beat. That's right. I remember that used to be furtum, 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 and they got these bloody elephants to put all their trunks up as they went past the stand. When they got in line with the Governor General's box, they'd all knee them. They put their knee, the Mahouts put their knees behind the ear, and they'd all raise up their trunks like this. Of course, a storm of applause would burst out. It mostly used to come from the children, I think. It started from them and went out like this. And, of course, what the thing was, the other band music was still fading into the distance as this fresh one came on. So there was an endless conveyor belt of different musics and colours. And all the time, this dust rising up from the Maidan and settling. It looked like a dream picture through a cloud of a strained gauze curtain, you know. Marvellous.
And it was only after the war came, and they tried hurriedly to mechanize these regiments, that one began to see that all that had gone before was a sort of dream, that it had all been something which would never, ever come again.
I don't think one talked about ideals. I don't think the British do, you know. No, I don't think so. Rather the reverse, really. I took it as a matter of course.
In the second of Plain Tales from the Raj, the speakers were Field Marshal Sir Claude Auchinleck, Lieutenant General Sir Reginald Savory, Spike Milligan, Rupert Main, Brigadier Sir John Smythe, V.C. and Lady Smythe, Lieutenant Colonel L.P. Lemarchand, John Morris, Sir John Cotton, Brigadier F.J. Dillon, Vere Lady Birdwood, Major General G.N. Wood, Lady Dring, Iris Portal, Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Mason and Leslie Johnson. The presenter was Evan Charlton. The field recordings were by Charles Allen and Prakash Mirchandani, and the program was composed and produced by Michael Mason.